Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome back to the podcast. Sorry we were off for a few weeks. I had a bad cold and I didn't feel like coughing in Ernest's face, and you appreciated that.
Very much.
So we'll be back with our full schedule. We got an exciting podcast today. More updates on Constellation Software. Since we recorded our last podcast on Constellation, we've had the sad news of Mark Leonard, the CEO and founder of Constellation Software, stepping down for health reasons. Stepping down from president, announcement of a new CEO. So we want to touch on that. We also want to talk a little bit about Domino's earnings as well as Costco's earnings and the accelerating sales we're seeing at Costco. And then finally, talk about Ferrari and some of the change, some of the impact that the stock has had as a result of the guidance that we think was misunderstood by the market. So we'll get all into that and more. But before we get into that, let's get into this. If you like this podcast, please subscribe to it on YouTube, on Apple, and on Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. And of course, Baskin Wealth Management, check out our new website. We are very transparent. We show you all our performance over the long term. We have lots of great blogs and videos and podcasts and great content. And if you're interested in becoming a client, please reach out. We'd love to chat to you about your portfolio and how we can help you with all facets of wealth management. So, Ernest.
I think Spotify announced that there was going to be podcasts on Netflix soon.
So,
could be us.
Could be us. We think of so many ways to monetize our fast-growing podcast. But thank you so much for anybody who subscribes and likes us. We're slowly seeing our podcast start to grow. We're spending a little bit more money on trying to improve our reach, and we're hopeful that you can spread the word. Ernest, are you still hot and heavy listening to podcasts? Business one, sports one, is that something on your regular rotation?
It does seem like there's a new one launched almost every day.
It's true.
I do have some core ones that I listen to, some related to investing, some related to business, some related to some of my own personal interests. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very unique format that is here to stay.
When do you listen to your podcasts? When you
mostly passively. Mm-hmm. While washing dishes, while driving to pick up kids.
You don't have a dishwasher?
Well, you can't. So my wife says that there's a lot of things that you can't put in the dishwasher.
Okay.
So you can't.
I think she's just making you work harder for some reason. She doesn't like you.
There have been times where I was driving with my kids and I was listening to a podcast about the Canadian energy industry. And then my son, who is now 9 years old.
Okay.
He asked me, why does everyone sound so sad on the podcast?
Well, they were happy a few years ago, but I guess their stock price, everybody wishes they just own gold now, of course, right? Instead of the black gold. it's funny how things rotate. So it's been a quiet year for us at Baskin Wealth Management. We haven't made too many trades in our portfolio. We've resisted the temptation to chase all the hot stuff that's in vogue today. And that's indicative of our style. We want to own companies that we can value, that deliver cash flow, growing cash flow per share. We've seen some of our top companies, report strong fundamentals, but maybe there's more rotation into other types of industries or sectors. But we haven't lost faith in any of the companies we own. And I think if we show our clients that we're not doing a lot of trading, that hopefully that's a sign to them that we feel comfortable with a lot of the investments that we own for the portfolio.
Yeah, I think every time there is something that is doing really well in the markets, I think you obviously have to study it and see if there's something that maybe you're missing to the story. Mm-hmm. But for things like gold, we've talked about so many times on this podcast before, that like I understand the story of about like rising debt in the US, uncontrollable government spending, geopolitical uncertainties and all these things, and why you need to own gold.
And why can't gold be in its own bubble? Like, why? I've never heard anybody say gold's in a bubble, yet they're quick to say stocks are in a bubble.
But I have looked at gold companies, and they just aren't the way that we like to invest.
Yeah.
So, for instance, I think a lot of these gold companies, in the end of the day, the cash flows are tied to the price of gold. They operate in geographies that we're not as familiar with. Like, it might be a mine in West Africa or something.
Certainly not comfortable investing in that.
Yeah. And so we're just going to stick to what we do.
Yeah, I know. And that's how markets go. Sometimes you look like a genius. Sometimes you look like a putz. But over the long term, I think if you stick with great businesses that where the fundamentals continue to improve, leave it alone. And that's really the strategy that we have. We were very active trading in 2024, very happy with a lot of the investments we made. Our most recent trade for our clients was selling CoStar and buying Taiwan Semiconductor. Yep. For now, that looks like a great swap. But, we'll see if we'll make further trades. It's really an interesting market, though. We talked about it on a number of podcasts where there's been, I mean, you got corporate earnings at record levels. You've got a number of stocks driving the market. Of course, those stocks are now gigantic global names.
Yes.
So I think like looking at indices, it's kind of irrelevant right now. You really should just look at these large global platforms wherever they exist, and that's the index, whether it's a Novo Nordisk or a gigantic Royal Bank in Canada. I don't know exactly what I'm trying to articulate here, but this is the world we live in, where there's some dominant companies that are going to take over the indices because their profits are just so massive and their reach is just so unbelievable, right? Microsoft, Apple, Amazon, billions and billions of customers around the world. And it's hard to see them losing that market share in the short term. We've seen a lot of exciting news from OpenAI. Every time OpenAI announces that they're going to do a deal with Oracle or Broadcom, or who else did they announce deals with?
OpenAI.
Oh, yeah, OpenAI. Yeah.
OpenAI did the Broadcom deal today.
Yeah, Broadcom. So, and many people are questioning, what the heck is going on? OpenAI, I think, is on track to maybe have $15 or $20 billion of revenue on a run rate today, which is in and of itself pretty amazing from zero, but they're signing hundreds of billions of dollars of deals for revenue that's yet to come. So a lot of people are questioning, what does this all mean? In our opinion, I mean, these are common deals that you see in tech. I urge everybody to read the new John Malone autobiography. You'll see a lot of circular deals that were done in cable. I mean, this is the way that companies help each other out, especially when there's new technologies that have yet to hit mass market level. And so to get that escape velocity revenue that you need full adoption, you need these deals to happen. So this is nothing new. If you study history, these types of deals have happened all the time.
Right. And we don't, just to clarify, we don't own NVIDIA stock for our clients. Mm-hmm. But I think that it seems to me that investing back into the ecosystem to drive growth and ensure that there is proper funding for the AI or whatever technology they happen to be investing in achieves this maximum potential, I think that seems to be the best use of capital for NVIDIA. Yeah.
I think we'll see some other tech companies probably do similar things, right? Amazon, Apple,
right.
Google, Microsoft, because they also have billions of dollars of cash, but actually they have the revenues to back it up.
Exactly. So, long story short, like, we are paying attention to what's happening, but I would be cautious about making any simple parallels to past situations, such as in 1999.
It's very hard. So let's move on to more specific topics. Like we said, we did a podcast on Constellation Software. One of the worries that in the stock price was the impact of potential AI on software. And I urge everybody to check out that podcast. I think we covered the pros and cons of AI and what Constellation is doing. By the way, Constellation Software is not going to tell you what it's doing. They operate in a very competitive industry, a lot of copycat businesses. We know 110% they're working on AI stuff to try and improve their products, but I don't think they're going to give you much detail because this is could be a real transformational. So since we did the podcast, unfortunately, as we stated at the top, Mark Leonard had to retire for now as president, founder of the company, linked to health issues. Hopefully, Mark will recover and be at full strength and maybe resume some more day-to-day work at Constellation at some point in time. I believe he's still remaining as chairman, correct?
He's on the board, yes.
He's on the board. And so the good news is stepping into his place is another Mark. This guy's name is Mark Miller, also pretty much a co-founder at Constellation. He sold his software business to Mark Leonard many, many years ago, right at the beginning. So he's been there since day one, pretty much.
Yeah, so he was part of the first ever acquisition that Constellation did. Mm-hmm. And so has been at Constellation for a long time, most notably running Volaris Group, which is one of their operating divisions. Became executive chair of Volaris a couple of years ago. And I think there were some hints that he was probably being groomed for this role, but now he's stepping into it.
Yeah.
And he held a call a couple of days after Mark Leonard announced he was stepping down.
A couple of weeks later after the stock price.
I
think they handled the communication a little bit. They should have had the call the day that Mark Leonard announced that he was retiring. They should have had a conference call announcing Mark Miller and talking about that it's business as usual. I think they waited a couple of weeks.
Yep.
That kind of caused some confusion. The stock price was ugly. It's since recovered a fair bit, but still, of course, down from its 52-week high.
Yeah, and I think there were some concerns about whether Constellation as a company is set up for life after Mark Leonard, mm-hmm. particularly because he is, there's a lot of magazine articles and people comparing Mark Leonard to as the Canadian Warren Buffett, mm-hmm. right? But I think it's important to keep in mind that Constellation Software, by its design, is an extremely decentralized company, and hence the name Constellation Software, mm-hmm. where all of the operating groups are largely run on an autonomous basis. Even the capital that they're investing, so the deals that they're making are done at the operating group level. And so even if Mark Leonard himself is no longer the CEO, most of the activity that is being done, like the way that the software businesses are operating and competing and transitioning to AI, or even the acquisitions that they're doing, are still going to continue because Leonard was not personally responsible
for Mark doing Leonard those wasn't things. Doing every acquisition. He wasn't going yay, nay, yay, yes. nay. He wasn't even probably consulted on the very small acquisitions,
yes.
only the one or two very large acquisitions that Constellation does each year. Well, they've got someone who's got just as much experience, Mark Miller. And so I think he commented a number of times on the conference call that the Constellation had with the investment community where they said, like, listen, it's business as usual. Nothing has changed. I think one of the key elements Mark Miller said is I'm a little more operational than Mark Miller said. I'm a little more operational than Mark Leonard. I ran a software company. Yep. I'm a software guy. Maybe that will give some comfort. I mean, the bottom line is you can't judge the future until we see the results that Mark Miller may or may not produce. Or it may be completely business as usual. Nothing changes. Maybe Mark Leonard comes back. Hard to know the future.
Right. And I think that in his kind of intro call with investors, mm-hmm. I think he really went out of his way to kind of say that there's no change in anything that Constellation is doing, mm-hmm. Whether it be on the ground, in terms of capital allocation, in terms of looking at large deals, or even looking at adjacencies beyond vertical market software, he's still involved in all of those discussions. And so I think that's what we want to hear as shareholders of the company.
For sure. And so obviously what matters most will be the results that Constellation will deliver over the next number of years, and for us to judge whether we want to own more of the stock, we want to reduce it, we want to get rid of it. You know, we'll have to see. But these are some big transformational worries that the market has, whether AI is going to disrupt Constellation Software, and also the founder stepping down. Interesting to note, of course, the same year that Warren Buffett is stepping down as well. So, you know, two of our, you know, heroes of capital allocation are out of commission, but at the right now, right? So we'll have to find new heroes, I guess. And so we're excited to see how Greg Abel at Berkshire, you know, what he does and shows his success, as well as Mark Miller at Constellation. Constellation, I think they, you know, we're beating a dead horse, but if those expect to see many more spinoffs, I think that's going to happen. I think they'll, you know, continue to add and implement AI strategies to improve their business as well as improve their software offerings. And we'll see, you know, how the future progresses under both Berkshire and Constellation Software. But, you know, nothing has changed in terms of our thesis or our approach for either companies.
Yep.
Yeah. Anything else you want to say there?
Yeah, I think there was there were a lot of questions about whether Constellation was going to start buying back stock.
Oh, because the stock price fell.
Yes.
And you know, take advantage of it. Before we say that, it was interesting to note that Mark Miller bought shares on the open market for himself.
Yeah. And right?
That was a good signal.
Yeah. And he explicitly said it's because he wanted to signal that he thought the stock was attractively valued.
Okay. So what did Mark Miller say on the call after the questions about the buyback?
But basically, he said no buybacks.
Yeah.
And he didn't really elaborate on it, but I think it makes a lot of sense, right? Constellation Software stock is trading at roughly, I don't know, 3-4% free cash flow yield, depending on how you adjust for the topic of stakes and those kinds of things. They're doing deals at 20, 25, 30% returns. Mm-hmm. So why would you want them to use cash to do buybacks versus going out and doing acquisitions?
The only reason they would do a buyback is if it would signal to the market the confidence in the management team. But I think they did it the best way by actually going out and purchasing shares.
Yeah.
That's the best signal of confidence. You know, putting down $1 million to buy shares, that's real after-tax money that someone used, especially Constellation Software, to buy shares and signal confidence. Yeah, you're right. If you're generating those types of returns, better to borrow money at 3-5% to try and reinvest that and earn 25% than buying back your stock at a 3-4% free cash flow yield.
And I think the fact that Constellation has not meaningfully increased its dividend over the years, or the fact that they're not doing buybacks, is a bullish sign that they think that they can deploy that capital efficiently.
That's right. Mature companies are ones that start buying back their stock because they have no reinvestment opportunities, right? Yeah. Or very few. You know, so that's a very good point. Today also, Ernest, we had a report from Domino's Pizza, a long-term holding in our portfolio. The stock has kind of been sagging the last few months. I think there's been, like I said, just rotation into more sexier AI gold names, you name it. But the results that they came up with today speak for themselves. You know, after a couple quarters of kind of weakish same-store sales, we've seen the past two quarters a really strong improvement. So are people ordering more pizza from Domino's, or is the stuffed crust pizza working? Like, where's the sales growth coming from? I thought the U.S. consumer is tapped out.
Yeah, so I think with Domino's, and I think this is true especially going into the discussion about Ferrari that we're going to have after this, is that I think, you know, the reported headline figures are one thing, but I think what we try really hard to do is look a little bit deeper into the company and the types of things that they're doing in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. And I think for both Domino's and Ferrari, I think we're really confident that they are doing the right thing, that the management understands the business, that they are aggressively competing to gain market share against weaker players.
They're doing some interesting tactics, Domino's.
Yeah.
They're offering free pizzas.
I got one myself.
Yeah, you got a free pizza. Was it good?
Yeah, it's Domino's.
So you and the free pizza, they would deliver it to you, or you have to spend
to go get it.
You have to go get it yourself. So nothing wrong with it's hard to get a free lunch, but that was free. A lot of deals. I think what Domino's is trying to do, obviously, is knock out the competition, right?
Yeah.
And you could see it in the results as well. The sales were up. The margins were a little bit down, I guess. Maybe there's a lot of moving parts there.
Yes, there are.
Like inflation is not going away anytime soon, but Domino's, I guess, is saying, we can beat the competition by keeping our prices stable, and we'll make it up on volume for now.
Yeah, and I think that so the headline result was that Domino's had 7% U.S. retail sales growth.
Wow,
which in and of itself is already very, 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 very good.
Yeah,
because this is in a backdrop of a weak low-end U.S. consumer. I think restaurant spending, it's flat to down in aggregate.
Mm-hmm.
And this is coming from, Domino's sales growth is coming from basically good execution on the ground by the franchisees. So, which includes, I think they launched the stuffed crust pizza, mm-hmm. which consumers like.
Mm-hmm.
Domino's
late to the game on stuffed crust pizza. Many of its competitors have offered stuffed crust pizza for years and years, but Domino's is very deliberate. It took its time. It wanted to get the technology right. I think we talked about it on one of these podcasts, how they explained to you that they needed a proper dough stretching machine and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
But these are the interesting things that you learn about companies who think long-term and do everything in the best interest of their customers and their franchises and their employees.
They had a promotion in the quarter called the Best Deal Ever.
Yeah.
Which is basically a $9.99 pizza that you can buy.
Mm-hmm.
And they said that the consumer response to that was very good.
I think it was like unlimited toppings or like a lot of
$9.99.
Yeah.
Which is in addition to their regular mix and match special.
Okay. And talk to us about the brand refresh that Domino's is going through.
Yep. And then they did a major brand refresh where the whole corporate identity, like the marketing materials, the pizza box that you get when you buy a pizza,
mm-hmm.
that's all being upgraded as well.
Mm-hmm.
So doing a lot of kind of on the ground things to drive consumer awareness of the company and improve positioning.
Any update on their new deals with Uber Eats and DoorDash? Is that proving out? Yeah. Is that working?
So DoorDash was not a hugely material. So they had just started a partnership with DoorDash where you can now order Domino's through DoorDash in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And that was not a material driver of sales this quarter, but will be for the rest of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And similar to the Uber partnership that they had, this was very carefully structured in a way so that it is driving incremental sales for Domino's rather than building up DoorDash's loyalty instead. So,
and we talked a while ago, Domino's doesn't, their stores don't have fryers, like deep fryers. Is that, and that's something that they're contemplating adding?
No, so one of the interesting things about Domino's is that all the food that you order at Domino's, the pizza, the chicken, the pasta, it all goes into the same oven at the same time.
And they have a conveyor belt type oven, yeah.
And it all comes out at the same time.
Yeah.
And this is done so that they can control the delivery speed.
So brilliant,
and
yeah.
improve the throughput of the stores. One of the things that people have asked is, are you going to start doing chicken wings?
Yeah.
Because that's that's the hot thing in the markets today.
Who doesn't love chicken wings? Yeah.
And Domino's said, well, one of the problems is we don't have fryers. Mm-hmm. So it's hard for us to
do that. They bake their chicken wings, but people love the deep fried chicken wings with the,
But they didn't say we're not doing it.
Yeah.
Which is something, which basically means that it's something that they're looking into.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so One thing that I want to point out is that all this stuff is great, but it's worth pointing out that they are doing this from a position of offense, mm-hmm. because if you compare Domino's results to Papa John's and Pizza Hut, which are their two main publicly traded competitors, they are, first of all, they are have the superior, their stores are the most profitable, which allows them to be able to do these specials in a way that competitors cannot match. Mm-hmm. And they are, especially in this environment where consumers are really looking for the best bargains out there, I think what Domino's is doing is really putting their foot on the pedal to really try and squeeze out the competitive landscape. Mm-hmm. So we saw this last year when, in the summer, Domino's made a change to their loyalty program, where they made it a little bit easier for you to redeem at lower tiers. Mm-hmm. So instead, before you might need to, like, let's say, I don't know the points system, but
yeah.
Let's say you needed X number of points to redeem a pizza. Now you can start redeeming for stuff like earlier than
Aren't companies going the other way? Tim Hortons, Starbucks, they're making their loyalty programs less attractive.
Yep.
Yeah. So
And this was very successful. And you saw that Papa John's later that year, they were basically forced to respond. They lowered the redemption tiers as well. So that's exactly what you like to see, is that you have a company that is the leader in the industry, and they're not using that, and they are using that dominant market position to gain more market share. And so I think that I feel really good about where Domino's is.
The final question I want to ask you about Domino's is growth opportunities going forward, right? So we all know that it's one of the best run quick service restaurants right up there with McDonald's. Yep. Just like a terrific business, run like a terrific factory. The franchisees do quite well. It's had some mixed results in some international countries.
Yep.
No question. Is there any sign in the horizon that they're going to be more aggressive opening stores? Anything that Domino's management has talked about recently?
So international is a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. There are some markets like China today, which are doing quite well. And the master franchisee is opening new stores. Stores are profitable. There's others like Japan today that are not doing as well. Maybe they overexpanded, but this is kind of the next leg of growth for Domino's going forward.
Okay.
I think I would note that, as with most fast food franchises, these are like the Domino's in China is not the Domino's that you know in the
US. Yes, of course. Like, much different menu. And
yeah, the types of things that they have there are very different. It's more catered to the local audience. And more importantly, from Domino's perspective, is that they make much more money from U.S. franchisees versus mm-hmm. international ones anyways. So it's something that's nice to have.
It was interesting. I also saw that Domino's leverage has come down a fair bit.
Yep.
With rising rates the last few years, it probably made sense. Free cash flow per share growing. I see they're buying back stock. The leverage is down. I mean, there's potential for the company to maybe do another recap or a large buyback. So we'll just have to see. Quickly, let's talk about Costco, a company that also offers great deals on pizza and hot dogs. The earnings were out a few weeks ago, as well as a recent announcement of the store sales, I guess, for September.
Yep.
And like people are still shopping at Costco like it's like they're going out of style, right? Is that the right way to describe it? But it's just huge demand, right? The same store sales are 8% growth.
Yep.
Is it the new stores that are resonating? Is it it can't be inflation that's helping?
No. It's basically that Costco really is the best business, in my opinion.
Yeah.
The best business model that exists. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to rehash their entire business model here.
No.
But
We've done that on several podcasts. Check it out.
Yeah, but they had very strong sales for basically every category. People want to go to Costco because they're getting better stuff for cheaper prices than they can anywhere else. Mm-hmm. They're opening new stores because some of their existing stores are getting so crowded that when you open a new one, then it actually increases the number of times that you're shopping there. And they added an extra hour for executive members, mm-hmm. which is helping for sure, because some people, again, want to avoid the crowds.
They're selling gold bars, and they're also offering deals on Ozempic, I think, for...
Yeah.
I mean, these are the types of things you can do when you have near 100 million... They have near 100 million members, right?
Yeah.
And counting, right? And so you can... It's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You can offer them better deals. You get better retention. You can raise prices. It's just a beautiful, beautiful machine with so many years of store growth opening ahead of it.
So one area that is interesting for Costco, an interesting opportunity for Costco, is digital ads. And this is something that they've historically not really done. E-commerce in general is a fairly new strategy for Costco overall. But Costco has begun basically creating an ad network where their customers can purchase ads on third-party websites. So outside of, you know, like on whatever website you happen to have.
Yeah.
And then you can click that ad and brings you back to Costco to buy that product.
Well, yeah. Okay.
And... this is an exciting opportunity for Costco because Costco owns all of their customer data. They know exactly who you are, what you like to buy, what your shopping habits are. And so this makes their ability to target ads to you extremely effective.
That's right.
And they've just started to realize this potential and are currently testing out their ad network and seeing very good results in it.
Such a phenomenal business. More services, more products, more stores.
And most importantly is that they're not using it to make money. They are using it to drive lower prices for their customers.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's something to watch for at Costco going forward as well.
Okay. So we talked about some exciting things. Some good, some bad, some ugly. The market reaction to Ferrari's guidance.
Yeah.
So this is the funny thing, or the problem I have with investing, right? A stock collapses because it's guiding for strong growth.
Right.
But the growth wasn't as much as what people are expecting, right? And so the reaction will be, okay, the stock got too expensive. I mean, and maybe that's the case. Maybe it's as simple as that. Stock went up too much. Now it's going down a little bit. I think some people called it a stunner of a guidance because Ferrari gave such strong, beautiful guidance for the last 4 years, 2022 to 2026. It exceeded that guidance. I think it gave guidance for like 10%, whatever, 10% growth of a specific metric.
Yep.
And that's going to come out to be about 15%. So it beat its expectation by a huge amount. It came out with guidance that was, I think, high single digits for growth over the next few years. And so the market's trying to understand what the heck is going on. Your cars are sold out for years. Every time you come out with a new car, the collectors snap it up.
Yep.
You're able to raise prices all the times. You're eventually going to come out with this EV that's so exciting and that should add to sales. So why isn't it showing up in the guidance? Why isn't the guidance more robust? And Ferrari will say, and we'll talk about it, it may be one of the issues with the company is it needs to retain the exclusivity of the brand.
Yep.
And to do that, sometimes it may have to limit the volume.
Yep.
So acting short term to benefit the long term. And, you know, we're long term investors. There's stocks that we've held in our portfolio for over 20 years. Ferrari, you've only held for 5 or 6 years.
I think more than that.
Well, whatever. I'm making a point that it hasn't been in the portfolio that long. I'm not looking to own it to 2028 or 2029. We're looking to own it for an extremely long time, as long as the thesis is unchanged or even improved. And if there's some short-term volume issues, maybe that will make the brand worth even that much more beyond 2030, if you get what I'm saying. So that's my take on Ferrari. I'll give it over to you.
Yeah, so basically Ferrari held every couple of years, every 4 or 5 years, they hold an investor day where they give out their targets for
a 4 or 5 year
period. And so last week they held an event where they said through 2030, they're going to have 4 or 5% annual revenue growth. Mm-hmm. And I think it's 7 to 8% profit growth.
Yeah, something like that. High single digit profit growth, less than what Ferrari has delivered in the recent past. Yeah.
And so I think the immediate reaction by, I think, many investors is, okay, they're guiding for this much earnings per share by this year. So we'll, you know, put a 30 or 40 multiple on that and then extrapolate what you would earn based on the current price.
Yeah.
And then that's the end of that. Yeah. Right. But as you pointed out, we're long-term investors, right? So I think what we care about is whether the management is doing the right things rather than whether every individual year the company is delivering certain revenue growth.
Well, you and I talked about it. It'll be very easy for Ferrari to give out double-digit earnings guidance for the next 4 years. Very easy. Launch more cars, raise prices aggressively. Bob's your uncle, and it will deliver the results, and the stock would have went up.
Yeah.
But I think the better way to think about it with Ferrari is, are you a short-term investor or you're a long-term investor? And a guidance is, you know, some companies give very conservative guidance, to play the game where they beat expectations and raise guidance. Ferrari is very good at that. As I mentioned, their guidance for the last few years was 10%. They delivered 15%. So maybe they're being conservative. Maybe there's some surprises that they don't want to tip their hat to. God only knows.
No, and I think this is an important point because we're saying you're a long-term investor is not just because the stock is down.
Yeah.
Right? Like here, when we do research, we really try to focus on whether the company is building itself up for the long term.
Yeah.
And I think that when I look at Ferrari's investor day, I feel really good about their future beyond 2030, which is what they set their targets
exactly.
at. Because
why is that?
And so first of all, embedded within their 5% revenue growth target is basically, they basically said they're not going to grow volumes. There's going to be zero volume growth and roughly 4 to 5% price/mix growth over the next 5 years.
Okay. And that's so, compounded per year.
Yeah. And there are certain areas of their portfolio that aren't doing that well. So for instance, in the UK, residual values are not good.
Yeah,
for Ferraris.
That's because they drive on the wrong side of the road and you can't really resell Ferraris with the steering wheel on the wrong side.
They drive on the wrong side of the road and rich people are leaving London.
Yeah, okay, interesting.
So that's one place that demand is not great.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is that electric vehicles are not, I think there's a bit of open question about whether people want to buy electric
vehicles. They do want to buy them, but the high-end electric vehicles are not selling across the board for any of the high-end manufacturers, right?
Yeah.
Porsche or Audi. I mean, they've got very expensive EVs that you're not seeing the adoption. Maybe it's the price. I mean, Ferrari's a whole different ballgame, right? This is a company that sells. You can't compare a Porsche to a Ferrari. I think what I'm trying to articulate is I think they're purposely trying to limit the volume on the electric because they're so excited about it, the EV vehicle, that it will be a grand slam home run. And that's the way to, create excitement and to create sales is limit the volume. People want them.
No, so I think So I think that was the main change from the management that originally Ferrari had planned that by 2030, 40% of car deliveries were going to be electric vehicle, pure EVs.
Okay, pure EVs.
Yeah, and part of this was due to regulatory requirements, but they now think that only 20% are going to be EVs. Mm-hmm. And part of that is because they went to their customer base and they asked them, do you want an electric Ferrari? And a lot of them said no.
They hadn't even seen this electric Ferrari yet.
But they said no, we're never buying an electric Ferrari.
Never is a long time, but yeah.
They said, we're not buying it. Mm-hmm. And so Ferrari, I think, maybe in response to this, they're a little bit more cautious about how they're approaching the launch. And I think that it's the right strategy, because if you look at how Ferrari has been building its business over the last couple of years, versus some of the other very high-end car makers, mm-hmm. all of the other very high-end car makers, so Lamborghini, Bentley, Rolls-Royce,
Aston Martin,
they have been ramping up production of SUVs and cars that appeal to a broader demographic. Hmm. So basically move down market and grow sales that way. If you look at what Ferrari did with their SUV, they did the opposite. The Puro Sangue, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly.
I can't pronounce it.
Ferrari SUV
is probably the way to say it. Yeah.
90% of sales of the SUV were to existing Ferrari customers. So it was not growing they were not selling it to other people. It was a very high performance vehicle, a V12 engine it was a V12 engine. It's not a hybrid like some of the other high-end SUVs out there. And
you couldn't get one.
And basically you couldn't get one.
Yeah.
So that's really the strategy that Ferrari is pursuing, is that they want to protect the brand by ensuring that only people who are really loyal to the Ferrari brand are able to purchase their cars. And I think they're doing the same thing with the EV, where by restricting access to it, making sure that only a limited amount of customers are able to buy it, they are able to showcase the uniqueness of the Ferrari EV before ramping up production.
And is there a reason to expect maybe growth picks up past 2030?
I think so. Yeah. Because they had a hint about this, because they said that half of their CapEx spend throughout this period is going to be for cars that are launched subsequent to 2030. Mm-hmm. So they clearly expect that things are going to pick up after that. And the number of rich people is, you know, not shrinking.
Certainly. No, it is not. It is not, especially if they're making all this money on...
So I really like the way that Ferrari is building up its business with the mind towards preserving the exclusivity of its brand.
Yeah.
And I think that was a consistent theme throughout the presentation, where they talked a lot about how they were growing their collector base, increasing the number of collectors that were out there. They talked about in-house manufacturing a lot of the components that go into the Ferrari to ensure that 50 years from now, you're still able to find that exact same part for the car. Mm-hmm. And they talked about, you know, building up the merchandise business, so the clothes and all those things, to preserve the brand halo of Ferrari as an aspirational brand, mm-hmm. right? And so I think all of these things put together, I think that the management is really understanding of what makes Ferrari special. And even if the financial targets over the next couple of years are not what we hope they would be.
Well, they always want more, but you want...
I think they're doing the right thing for the long term.
That's right. And as we mentioned, Ferrari has a history of under-promising and over-delivering in terms of its results. As well, this is a company that thinks in decades, not in 3 to 4 year increments. You know, the guidance game is tough. We prefer companies don't give guidance, but I get it why Wall Street wants targets. And this is the game that is being played by Ferrari. Keep in mind, of course, as long-term investors, Ferrari is very aggressive on buybacks as well. Uses a lot of its free cash flow to buy back stock. It's also planning to raise its dividend payout ratio. It pays out its dividend based on a percentage of earnings, and it expects earnings to grow and going to raise that percentage that it's going to pay out of earnings to shareholders as well. So in our opinion, it was all good news. Maybe it didn't reach the expectations that people wanted, but you know, we're very excited to be Ferrari shareholders. And if the market gives us the ability to buy this stock at a pretty good discount, we'll happily buy more and you know, add it to people's portfolios. Anything else?
Are you
going to
buy one anytime soon?
I am not going to buy a Ferrari, but I got to tell you, I think I lost a Ferrari and owning the stock recently. But over time, I'm more pleased to own Ferrari stock than a Ferrari car. And I'm not a very good driver, and I'd be scared, you know what, to drive one. So with that, we'll leave it there. And we promise to have many more podcasts going forward. Once a week is what we'll try. And we're so happy to have you listen and follow us. And we'll see you back here real soon.
This podcast is for informational purposes only. And any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.